Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Lowest unemployment rate in the country in May, North Dakota. 9.7 nationally, 3.6 out on the Great Plains. A brimming state budget surplus while many states face insolvency. Full restaurants, booming housing demand. It's like another world economically on the Great Plains right now. This hour On Point, we'll look at why, at ag, energy, wages, and what it all means for the region and for the rest of the country. You can join the conversation. Are you tempted to grab a Conestoga wagon and head for the Great Plains? Are you thinking twice about Fargo, Bismarck, Omaha? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And what about those Buffalo comments? Joining me now from New York is Joel Kotkin, Distinguished Fellow in Urban Futures at Chapman University in California. His latest book is The Next 100 Million, America in 2050. His new article in Newsweek is The Great Great Plains, How Heartland Cities Like Fargo and Omaha Became the Nation's New Boomtowns. Joel Kotkin, welcome back to On Point.
Nice to be here.
Put us on the main drag in Fargo. You've been there recently. What's it like?
It was just amazing. You know, I first started going to Fargo about 10, 15 years ago, and it was like many towns in the Great Plains and in large parts of the Midwest, sort of nothing happening in the downtown. It was very dull. You couldn't get a decent cup of coffee. I actually used to bring my coffee with me from Los Angeles.
Oh, you're so coastal.
I am. And then over the years, there's been this kind of evolution. There's a nice boutique hotel. There are some nice restaurants. So I was there on a Thursday with a friend of mine who lives in the area. And we were walking around. We wanted to go get a drink. Couldn't get to the bar. It was packed with these young people. I said, where did these people come from? And what I've noticed is that these cities, most particularly Fargo, but also Omaha, some of the other ones, have really shown a kind of revitalization. And, you know, the key, and which urbanists are always discussing, why does one city do well and why does another not do well? And they never really focus on the real issue, which is jobs, particularly in this economy.
The lowest unemployment in the country in North Dakota, Fargo's North Dakota in May. What's the region that you have in mind when you talk about this great, great plains?
Well, I think, you know, there are a lot of definitions, but I would really take it from the Canadian border down through Texas. I mean, you know, really Dallas is on the Great Plains as well, and it's also doing reasonably well. It's a part of the country that, you know, generally speaking, is mostly flat, although some parts are a little bit hilly. Some parts of it are kind of dry, depends which side of the 100th meridian you are. You know, it's a part of the country that for many, many years was really emptying out. And much of it, and this is something I wanted to emphasize, mm-hmm. both in the book and in the Newsweek piece, this doesn't mean that the stories about the small towns, isolated small towns being deserted are not true. That is happening too. And what we're seeing, and I think this will be discussed later, mm-hmm. is that there is a movement within North Dakota to the larger towns. In some cases, those larger towns are 20, 30,000. Sometimes they're a metro area of well over 100,000.
Yeah, we're going to talk with Frank Popper, who was one of the co-authors of the Buffalo Commons thesis about this whole area. And as you say, it's really the cities you're talking about. Still a lot of small towns in trouble. We'll hear more about that. I mean, we've heard about that on this show, about you've got Iowa included in your sort of Great Plains, Des Moines description here, but we've got small towns with meth labs and troubles that come from depopulation that we've heard about. But what are the engines driving the growth where there is the growth? And there's a lot of it overall, I guess. I mean, the state coffers are absolutely jammed in North Dakota. What's driving this, Joel?
Well, I think the thing that's really the strongest is energy. There's an enormous amount of oil, great potential natural gas. There's coal. I mean, obviously, there's reasons to be ambivalent on that. But certainly, that's a very strong industry. Agriculture has its ups and downs. But, you know, you have a world with 3 billion more people by 2050, lots of desire for foodstuffs, including animal proteins. I know it's not popular among some circles to talk about it, but you know what? Certainly popular when you get to China and Singapore and other developing countries that are moving their way up. And then the most interesting thing has been the growth of technology, particularly in the Fargo Grand Forks corridor. And there's some similar movements I've seen in parts of South Dakota as well. And that is really that they're very high level of education. The kids in the Great Plains are just they're just a whole nother breed than what you see on either coast. They have very high graduation rates. The schools are very good. And so, I mean, they've really beginning to pick up. The question is whether or not they're going to take this moment in their history and take advantage of it to drive the point home, to go further. You know, people say, how could you possibly have successful places in a cold, flat part of the country? Well, I can give you one word answer. Minneapolis seems to be doing fine.
Absolutely doing fine. What about costs there? And what about wages there? I mean, I think a lot of people's perception of this region is low cost, low housing costs and so on, but also low median incomes.
Well, I think that that's somewhat changing. I think it really depends. I think there's no question that a person working in a store or even in a manufacturing plant is likely to make a little bit less than they would somewhere else. But, of course, the cost of living is much less. But there's really a growth in high-wage jobs. And, of course, the energy sector is pretty well known for having fairly high wages. So there is some low wage, there is some high wage. But when we did the study, I work with my colleagues at the Praxis Strategy Group, which is actually out of Grand Forks. Mm. And we went over the country and looked at where were their middle-class jobs being created, where were the fastest growth of technology, engineering, management jobs. And North Dakota was really close to the top in both categories. So something is happening there besides just low-wage employment.
And as you say, high education rates. North Dakota, for example, ranks third, Minnesota fourth, just after Washington, D.C. and Massachusetts in the percentage of residents between the 25 and 34 with college degrees.
And that's very surprising because for years, the great lament, and it was true, is that everyone leaves and nobody comes back. I think what you're seeing is people still, some young people with educations leave, more come back because there's more to come back to. And also that some people from other parts of the country are going there as well. And in this economy, if we're going to be in a job-short economy for the next 5 to 10 years, the prospects for this part of the country will improve considerably.
So you've got this really interesting scenario, all kinds of trouble on the coast, the Rust Belt and beyond. No paradise here, but unemployment rates on an entirely different strata right now than we've got nationally. That means jobs. That matters a lot to people. On the other hand, as you say, Joel, a lot of concentration of that in cities, still some depopulation, pretty significant in small towns. A couple of decades ago, Frank Popper and his wife Deborah Popper had a big article, The Great Plains from Dust to Dust, talking about the Buffalo Commons, about kind of giving a bunch of this region back to Mother Nature, in effect, opening it up, let the herds of bison come back. Frank Popper joins us right now from New Brunswick, New Jersey. Frank, thanks very much for being here.
Happy to be here.
So what do you make of your thesis 20 years on? I mean, back in the day, it wasn't very popular out there. I remember reading, you know, you had to have bodyguards some places. There were death threats. People didn't like your vision of what this might become. You know, bleak future was one of the headlines in those days. What do you see going on now, Frank?
Well, first of all, everything Joel says about the cities is right, but as I'm sure he knows and that mm-hmm. it's mentioned in the Newsweek article, a lot of that growth is based on the continued slowly depopulation of dozens of towns in North Dakota, probably thousands of towns across the Great Plains. It would be rude to name any, but certainly all local residents know what they are. And these are places that have been depopulating often since the Dust Bowl. Maybe they had the highest population in 1930, just before the Dust Bowl, or in 1920, and there are places, including places in North Dakota, you could point to that actually had their high population in 1890 and have been steadily losing people, particularly young, enterprising, talented people, again, like the kind Joel talks about.
But at this point, not necessarily losing them from the region, maybe just from the little town. I mean, you wrote back in the 80s, much of the plains will inexorably suffer near total desertion over the next generation.
But we were clear that we were talking about the deep rural plains.
Yes, right.
Not about the Fargos, not about the Omahas, not about the Denvers.
So what do you see coming now? Could you have that Buffalo Commons, that kind of wild, deserted plains, and speckled across it these flourishing cities?
Yeah. No, both things can happen. Mm-hmm. They can, in fact, reinforce each other, help each other. And the real large vision, and Joel is certainly helping to create this, is the idea of an economically vibrant urban plains at the same time that you have the various nature preserve options of the Buffalo Commons that are clearly developing.
You said you wanted to take the region back to its pre-white state, I guess speaking racially, to deprivatize. Sounds funny these days, but maybe, I mean, it's one of the whitest parts of the country, in fact, but is that got any traction? Do you see
the country all by itself?
Do you see, I don't know, more area being opened up to, you know, prairie dogs and buffalo?
Oh, certainly, yeah. I mean, this is actually happening on the ground as, for example, more farmers and ranchers switch to buffalo, as Indian tribes, which have huge tribal land holdings, get more heavily into buffalo, as many are doing, and more heavily into buffalo culture, as many are doing. You have all kinds of nonprofit organizations, some in the plains, some outside. And in the plains version would be the Texas-based Great Plains Restoration Council, of which I'm the board chair. But the Nature Conservancy, the country's largest land preservation organization.
So a little Buffalo Commons plus an economic boomlet, maybe boom here. Frank Popper, thank you very much for checking back in with us on that front. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about economic good times in the cities of the Great Plains, while the rest of the country's economy very widely struggles. Not so long ago, the talk was of giving the region back to the buffalo. Now it's of boom towns. Joel Kotkin has written about it in a Newsweek piece, The Great, Great Plains, how heartland cities like Fargo and Omaha became the nation's new boom town. Joel Kotkin joins us from New York City, and right now from Dickinson, North Dakota, we're joined as well by Deborah Dragseth. She's Associate Professor of Business at Dickinson State University in North Dakota, author of Should I Stay or Should I Go?, a study of out-migration of college students there not so long ago. Everybody cites her. Deborah Dragseth, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
What do you think of Joel's boomtown description of the cities in your neck of the woods?
I think Joel's right on target. It's exactly what I've been seeing. I've been a professor here at Dickinson State for 21 years, and we're seeing that shift happen and happen faster.
Are people feeling it? Are people talking about it? Is it? I mean, you know, it's one thing to put it in Newsweek, but does it fly in the local newspapers? Do people say, yeah, we're in a boom?
Yes, we are in a boom. There's no question about that. Wages are going up. Jobs are plentiful. People are excited about the future of North Dakota. As Joel pointed out, we have a excess of money. The oil money, the energy money is, they estimate about $500 million this year just in taxes from that oil money. And next year, probably over $1 billion in a state our size. That's a lot of money, and we need to decide how we're going to shape and form our future.
You've barely got 600,000 people and $500 million surplus in the state budget. I mean, states around the country must just absolutely tear their hair out with envy when they hear that, Deborah.
I think that's true, and I talk to other college professors around the country, of course. You know, that's my world is a university. Mm-hmm. And you see programs being cut, universities being squeezed, you know, problems happening with their budgets in higher education and also K-12. And we're seeing none of that in North Dakota. We're really moving forward and seeing it as a significant opportunity for our education system.
I mean, you personally have been talking about a future where, for example, college education might be free in your area there and lure used to bring in top students from around the world.
And that's an idea that's being bantered about. Our legislature meets here only every 2 years. We don't apparently have a lot of business going on, so we only have to meet every 2 years. But we're hoping that's something that's going to be at the top of the discussion list this winter, is what can we do with this excess cash that's going to help North Dakota, not in the next 5 or 10 years, but, you know, generations.
And that at a time when around the rest of the country, you know, their college costs are going up and up and they're cutting back.
Right.
You know, I wonder, Deborah, as we looked at Joel's piece and thought about this, I mean, one idea that was on the table was, well, okay, here we go, American jobs headed, in this case, not off to China or to India, but off to the one of the lowest cost and traditionally lowest wage parts of the country. Is this a kind of, you know, offshoring to the middle of the country? Is this the American economy flowing to its lowest compensation, you know, region?
Well, we certainly hope that people in other parts of the country don't see it that way. Our wages are increasing. It's true that North Dakota has had lower wages. North Dakota and South Dakota trade places back and forth with the lowest paid teachers, K-12 teachers. We have about around 9% less national average wages than the rest of the country, but that's definitely improving. That's going up. And a lot of the energy jobs and technology jobs, as Joel mentioned, mm-hmm. are high-paying jobs. You can be a truck driver out in the oil field and make $80,000 a year.
That sounds pretty good. We'll look at energy. We'll look at tech. But, Joel, what's your sense? And what about this response that, well, okay, this is the downshifting of the American economy to just lower wage, lower cost, lower, lower, lower?
Well, I just don't think that that's necessarily the case because, again, you have some growth of high-wage jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And also there are functions that are going on. One of the interesting things I've run into in the Dakotas, not just North Dakota, but South Dakota, Iowa, has been the growth of and actually Nebraska as well, which is the growth of, let's say, call centers, jobs that were going to India that are now actually being done in the middle part of the country, in the Great Plains, where you have a relatively low cost of wages, but you have a well-educated population that also speaks English. I don't know about you, but, you know, and I spend time in India, and I love India, but you know what? I don't like to have my questions about my computer or my cell phone dealt with by somebody who's reading a script.
But isn't that just the point, that instead of going to India, now these calls are going to low-wage Great Plains regions? I mean, isn't it the same wage pressure that puts on the coast, or is that the wrong way to look at it?
Well, that's part of it, but it's also the skill sets that are available at a wage rate. In other words, I think it would be very difficult at, let's say, $12 an hour, $13 an hour to get highly qualified people in New York or L.A. to do work, people who could speak English well, who would be able to work with customers in an efficient way. You can find those people in the Great Plains. You know, that, and maybe the wife of that oil truck driver that Deborah's talking mm-hmm. about, maybe she makes another $20,000-$30,000. So that's $110,000 a year for a couple living in Bismarck. You know, that's pretty good living in that part of the country. That buys you a very nice house and an extremely high standard of living. Not for everyone. I mean, I'm a coastal guy. I probably, you know, wouldn't last very long there. But for a lot of people, it's a very viable option and will become more so as our population goes from around 300 mm-hmm. to 400 million.
Great for the Great Plains, absolutely. But Deborah, is it good for Americans, you know, sort of listening to this on the coast and wondering, well, what does this mean for us? I mean, instead of, you know, offshoring to India, we're going to offshore to South Dakota and pay $12 an hour instead of the, I don't know, 20 in New York, and that job's gone?
And I think those wages will go up. I don't mm-hmm. think that that's something that's going to be, you know, a forever situation. As Joel said, we have a manufacturing facility here, and I've talked to the CEO many times, and around 600 or 700 employees, and he said, you know, I can get 100 people apply for a job. I can look at 100 resumes, and over 90 of them will, you know, almost 90-95% will have a high school degree. Half of them will have a college degree. People mm-hmm. here are very well educated, and they're hard workers. I'll give you a quote from an engineering company in town, and he said, we want to hire an engineer who grew up on a farm. They have a good work ethic, they're resourceful, and they tend not to complain. And people here are very, they're hard workers, they're intelligent, they're educated. It really is a wonderful place to live, and we see our future is a very bright future.
Great Plains sounding great in that description. Let's hear from our callers, Peggy in Lake City, Iowa. Peggy, what do you know?
Well, we've moved. I've been listening to what you've been saying, and I hate calling India myself. I've seen call centers open. I live outside of Carroll, Iowa.
Okay.
Between Carroll and Fort Dodge, Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in upstate New York and moved to California in high school. So I lived everywhere from Orange County to Fresno.
Okay.
I think where I moved to in Lake City, Iowa, is the best kept secret on the planet. I would, yeah, the wages are a little bit lower, but the housing is significantly lower, which makes up for it. The quality of living's better. There's no graffiti. There's no crime, per se.
What about amenities? I don't know, social services, you name it.
I have a hospital within a mile. I have a clinic within a mile. I have a thrift store within a mile. I have everything from an auto shop to a towing place to a dealership to, I'm trying to think, what, a feed store, an auto parts,
that's great.
Grocery store.
Right.
I can't, there's... four generations of us have all moved here,
wow.
Mostly from California.
Yeah.
We would rather live here, all of us would rather live here than anywhere else in the United States. And I've traveled all over the United States.
But what should your native New York take from this, Peggy? What should your longtime California people take from this?
Well, let me put it this way. I paid $22,000 for a gorgeous house.
$22,000?
$22,000. I did put new carpet linoleum, and it needed a little paint.
Sure.
My daughter bought a house for $4,500.
Wow. People are just keeling over in New York and California.
Yes. My son bought... See, I sold my house for $227,000.
You're in the pink there. You're in the pink in Lake City. It sounds like good living, and I appreciate your call. Let's get one more. Linda in Des Moines. Thank you, Peggy. Linda, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, my husband and I both grew up in small town Iowa and were educated here and got married after college and immediately left Iowa for the big city, had that small town chip on our shoulders and lived in downtown Chicago, loved it, but after about 4 years realized we didn't want to live in the suburbs, there was too much traffic, it was too expensive. We moved back to Des Moines, Iowa to be closer to our families, and as the previous caller said, we did make a little bit less than we'd been making in Chicago, but the mm-hmm. difference in the housing prices was amazing. We got an incredible house here that we never would have been able to afford in Chicago, and that was in about 95, 96. Since then, Des Moines has gone through just a rebirth. There are fabulous restaurants. There are cultural things to do. There are arts, world-class athletic events. It's just amazing all the things that there are to do, and the downtown is completely revitalized.
So, Linda, when you read, you know, about the rest of the country, which has really got big problems, I mean, right next door to you there in Illinois, for heaven's sakes, never mind the rest, the sort of gloom and doom headlines, do you relate to that? Do your neighbors? Does it seem like a different country? Or
no, we do, and when you know, we all went through the recession with everyone else, and there were job losses. But it we weren't hit as hard. The housing prices fell a little, but not nearly what they had fallen in other parts of the country because they weren't inflated as much to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So we felt it, but we just felt it a lot less.
Feeling good in Des Moines. It's fascinating, Linda. Thanks for your call, Deborah. Let's look at these two big pillars of the economy. The first, I mean, there's energy. We'll look at that, but agriculture. What's going on with that? And is that a I don't know, with climate change, on the one hand, Joel points out, we've got a big growing population globally. Does that mean long-term demand, long-term high prices or not? And what about climate change? A lot of the Great Plains has always been sort of marginal in terms of agriculture. Not all of it, certainly, but big chunks have been right on the edge of, you know, enough growing season. How's it work?
Well, wheat is our big crop in North Dakota, and a lot of our success in farming certainly depends on the price of the crops that we grow, sunflower, wheat, those are a couple of big ones, and also the price of input. So certainly when oil was, you know, when fuel was so high about a year and a half ago, you know, you're looking at $4 a gallon gas, that was very, very difficult for farmers because their inputs were it was a classic profit squeeze. You know, the prices of inputs were going up, and that was a real problem. But that has seemed to have mitigated, and 90% of North Dakota is farms and ranches, 90% of the land in North Dakota. So that is a big, big part of our economy. But it really is our success here as farming is predicated upon high prices, low price inputs.
And Joel, on the energy front, I'm reading you writing recently that the BP oil spill disaster and the big chill that it's putting on offshore oil, it turns around and become kind of a backdoor, another reason for the boom in the Great Plains, because they've got other kinds of energy that are going to be needed.
Well, I think that's absolutely the case, because the you know, whatever one thinks about what happened in the Gulf, I think it's going to be very difficult to get, let's say, drilling in off the coast of California or the coast of Florida. I think that the politics now are just would be almost impossible. So where would you go for developing all forms of energy? You know, even renewable energy, wind power, for instance. You know, there are negatives to that as well, and a lot of NIMBY pressure. You don't see that so much in the Great Plains. The big problem I hear in the Great Plains is the transmission lines, particularly for wind, moving the power to the places where the power is needed, for instance, like Chicago. And I think that that's going to be a big challenge. But I think that you know, the two big plays in energy were offshore and in the basically largely in the Great Plains, a lot of natural gas potential. And I think that that's where we're going to end up going. I think there'll be less political reaction against it. And you won't have the problem of the oil going onto the beaches, which, you know, is clearly going to make it very difficult to have more drilling offshore.
Deborah, we've got a comment here from the website. This is from Jeff, says the growth is in fossil fuels such as coal, natural gas. I wonder if these cities we're talking about are going to plan smart, or are they just going to go the way of the Southwest, promote sprawl? What do you see happening, Deborah?
Well, we hope that we plan smart. And as Joel said, we've also definitely a windy state. There's opportunity there. And as you kind of linked it in with farming, there's biofuels as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's another piece of it. We truly believe that growing our education, educating our population, and making North Dakota a better place for the people who already live here and a more alluring place for other people to move. We have a lot of room in North Dakota, as Joel's book, you know, the next 100 million. We have a lot of room in North Dakota, and, you know, we're hoping to make it more of a state that people would want to move to. I just saw recently that North Dakota was ranked the second happiest state in the nation and the second least stressed state. The happiest state is Montana, go figure, and the number one least stressed state is Hawaii. But, you know, you combine those two together, and, you know, you're looking at a pretty great place to be.
But I wonder if is there some kind of new model here? I mean, we heard from Frank Popper saying the Buffalo Commons idea of, you know, endless waves of kind of untouched nature and buffalo roaming, returning to that. Can that, will that live alongside thriving cities? That's a picture I haven't exactly seen before, Deborah.
And there's a potential, a good potential, I think, of that happening. As I said, I've been a college professor for a couple of decades here. I do a lot of research. Just last month, we had 111 high school students to our university, and I asked them what size of community they live in now. 77% live in a town of less than 2,000 or a farm and ranch. And I asked them what size of community they wanted to live in, and you were looking at a handful, like a dozen, that said they wanted to live in a community of less than 2,000 or a farm and ranch once they grew up and found their career. They're really focusing on that 50 to 150,000. So those sponge cities that Joel wrote about, the Fargos, the Bismarcks, that are soaking up these small communities that are really withering. And, you know, and in a lot of ways, that's a shame. The larger communities gain is the small towns loss.
But they're gaining sponge cities, as you say. We've got a correspondent here, Joel, saying, isn't Fargo nightlife the definition of an oxymoron? You say no. You've been there.
I
have to say, it's a shock to me, but you go to Monty's or you go to the Donaldson Hotel bar, and I'm telling you, it's the Upper West Side.
Wow. We'll look at the high-tech piece when we come back. Joel Kotkin, please stand by, and Deborah Dragseth in Dickinson, North Dakota. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about economic good times in the cities of the Great Plains while the rest of the country struggles economically. Not so long ago, the talk was of giving the region back to the buffalo. Well, that may happen, but now there's a little bit of boom time going on as well, and it's fascinating. Joel Kotkin's written about it in Newsweek magazine. His piece is The Great, Great Plains. Deborah Dragseth is with us as well. She's from the Dickinson State University in North Dakota, author of Should I Stay or Should I Go? Increasingly, not in little towns necessarily, but certainly in the cities of the Great Plains, the young are staying. Sponge cities, they call them. Let's get a call from East Hampton, Connecticut, and Brent. Brent, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Brent. Glad to talk to you.
You too. What's on your mind, Brent?
Well, you know, I was born and raised in Dodge City, Kansas. Actually, I was raised in a small town close to Dodge City.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up, and I actually moved away from there about the time that you're talking about in the early 80s or late 70s when it was just completely depressed. And I did a career with the Navy, and I moved back there recently and lived here for 3 years to be with my parents. We're going through some tough times.
Mm-hmm.
And I was amazed that there's actually more jobs than there are people there. And, I mean, and there's more housing than there are people available as well.
So did it look robust to you economically since you left and came back?
Yeah, actually it did, very much so. You know, Dodge City, Kansas, Larned, Kansas, all those towns around there. Garden City, Kansas in particular, it's just a boom town.
What are the jobs in Dodge City, Kansas?
Well, you know, it's just like it's always been. It's the cattle industry. You only now, instead of coming in by rail or being herded up by, you know, cowboys, you have all these semi-trucks driving into Dodge City with cattle on them, and it's a big meatpacking industry now, and all the different ancillary businesses that go along with that.
So meatpacking may not be everybody's cup of tea for a job. On the other hand, a job is a good thing in itself these days. Brent, thanks for calling. Deborah, what about the housing issue? Is there, you know, we understand housing is pretty low cost. Does that mean it's plentiful, or are you outstripping your supply now in the cities there?
It really depends on the part of the state that you live in. In the eastern part, in Fargo, probably Bismarck East, you aren't going to have a problem finding a house. Now, where I live, I'm kind of on the southern tip of that energy crescent, and housing in places like Williston, very, very difficult to get rental housing, and housing costs are going up because of the influx of the oil boom and the oil workers, and that's a real challenge for that particular part of the state there in that energy crescent. We have about 8,000 workers just working in that oil field part of our economy, and so the cheap houses are not to be found in the energy crescent.
Don't look there, right. But so is not all perfection on that front. Let's go to Robert in North Hero, Vermont. Robert, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom.
Yeah.
Great show, as they often are. I live in a very rural part of Vermont up in the northwest corner.
Okay.
It's every bit as rural as North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful, extreme weather, just like our friends in that state. And
right.
Yet, you know, this state is struggling. It financially, it's in real trouble. The young people are leaving. And I think there's a part of the answer. I haven't heard anybody mention it yet today, at least in the time I've been listening.
Okay.
It just has to do with, to me, sort of not only politics, but social perspective. Because you have some states, Vermont's one of them, has just risen to try and address every human need, take care of every possible setback. It's a very, very generous state, but it has no more money. It's and upstate New York is exactly the same way. They're our friends to the west. They've just promised and promised and promised, and they're broke.
So you see a smaller government, but of course, for a long time, Great Plains had smaller government and less money.
It's true, but if you drive through the Midwest, I'm sure you've done it. You just come away with the perspective that these people are resourceful, that they don't rely on others nearly as much as, say, for example, states on the coast, on both coasts.
Well,
they don't look for aid; they look to solve their own issues, I think that's got a lot to do with this discussion.
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, I have to say I've seen pretty resourceful people all over, but, of course, there are also different mindsets. Let's get maybe a response to that right from the region, Omaha, Nebraska. Gary, you're on the air. What do you think, Gary?
Hi. Well, I'm just concerned that maybe we haven't really changed that thinking at all. It's just that we're sort of going through a little bit of a bubble and that maybe the governments, the local governments, city governments and stuff like that, may not be reacting in a way that's going to have any long-term benefits. I see a lot of waste, a lot of foolishness, and a lot of the kind of stuff that comes out of a bubble mentality. And, you know, the buffalo thing is great because, you know, I eat organic and I eat buffalo meat and stuff like that. That would be great if that continues to expand. But I worry a little bit about what the cities are doing as far as how they're managing and governing themselves and everything.
So watch out for bubble mentality. Joel, what about it? Does it feel, does it look like a bubble to you, like this may be a brief moment in the sun or something more?
Well, you know, I think that there's certainly you should be concerned with that because, you know, bubbles happen a lot. But I'll say a couple of things that are sort of on a strategic global level will make mm-hmm. that a little bit unlikely. One, I think the price of energy is not likely to drop dramatically. It will go up and down. But you have the presence now of particularly India and China just overwhelmingly driving both the energy prices and over time, I think, agriculture prices as well. And those are really major things that are different. You know, in the 1980s, the United States and Europe really drove what was happening on energy prices. Today, what's happening is really being driven increasingly by China and India. So I think that's a major change. But I thought the question of the politics is interesting. I think that what I like about the Great Plains is that both Republicans and Democrats understand the importance of infrastructure, the university system, and the idea of building the foundation. But at the same time, I do find in North Dakota a very strong sense of community. So in other words, people aren't – they're self-reliant, but they're really reliant in through churches and sort of extended social networks that exist in these communities, which makes you a little bit less dependent on – a social welfare state. You know, also, if you sort of know your neighbors and you know the people around you, that provides a safety net that is not dependent on government spending. I mean, it's clear, as the call from Vermont said, that many states in both the Northeast and in California and also parts of the Pacific Northwest have become so involved with every conceivable issue, whether it's, you know, climate change or foreign policy, or helping the poor in every conceivable way, that they've now taken on such a burden that it's very hard for them to meet. In these societies, I think you have less of that existing social problem and much more of a social network that takes care of things on the community level.
Of course, they're low population. You've got, you know, just less social challenge in general. But on the other hand, I have to say, you know, it made a big impression when people were facing floods out there. We all saw on television those enormous long lines of citizens out passing bags of sand down to build to bolster the levees against that community spirit. You see, on the other hand, we've got skepticism here, too, on the website. Here's one correspondent says, please, North Dakota, 680,000 people, they get all their money from energy, very fortunate, but don't tell me they're doing something miraculous. Be born to rich parents or live on a bunch of coal or oil. Well, there's the pushback. I want to bring one more voice in here, if we may. From Los Altos, California, Rich Carlgaard comes back to On Point, publisher of Forbes magazine, author. We talked to him a few years back about his book Life 2.0, how people across America are transforming their lives by finding the where of their happiness. He got in a plane, flew all over the place, came and told us there's a lot of good places to live out there. Rich, welcome back. Thank you very much for being here.
Happy to be here.
What do you hear in this talk of and reality right now anyway of boom in the Great Plains? Is this the justification of your thesis? Is this a long-term trend toward a part of the country we thought of as sort of hollowing out or something else?
Well, one of the things that have not been mentioned so far, and Joel has pretty much touched on all of them, and so is
Deborah here. Mm-hmm.
But the technology revolution. I was born and raised in Bismarck, North Dakota. And when I was in high school in the 1970s, one day we had a blizzard and it took out our two television stations, and we were reduced to watching reruns of Batman for 3 days. You know, that old campy Batman with
mm-hmm.
Adam West.
Right.
And now, you know, you go back and everybody gets the same cable TV stations. Everybody has the giant flat panel displays, and everybody has broadband ubiquitous internet. So the communications revolution has really included the Great Plains, so you don't feel nearly as disconnected from the world as you did before, either culturally and even more importantly, economically. So there's a tremendous arbitrage opportunity in the Great Plains to conduct business at a much lower level of cost and still being right in the flow of the world's information.
And never mind industry itself. Joel reminds us of Great Plains Software, founded out in North Dakota in the mid-1980s. Microsoft bought it in 9 or 10 years ago for $1 billion-plus. They've got
this was Doug Burgum's company, and it really refutes the comment from the person who said you either have to be born to rich parents or lie on a bed of coal or oil.
Mm-hmm.
Because Doug Burgum mortgaged his family's grain elevator for the financing of Great Plains. It was touch and go for many years. I once asked Doug, after Microsoft bought Great Plains in 2001 for $1.1 billion, what it was like to report to Steve Ballmer, the legendary tough guy CEO of Microsoft.
Yeah.
And he said, Ballmer's a pussycat compared to your uncles on a 4th of July picnic when they think they're going to lose the family grain elevator.
Watch out. But here's my question, Rich Carlgaard. I mean, you're publisher of Forbes, so there's a certain political perspective baked right into your position, your publication. But I mean, are there lessons for the rest of the country here? Or is this, you know, despite the success of Great Plains Software and the technology strands in here, is this a story of a unique region that finds itself in a sweet spot right now?
Well, I think so. For the long-term energy trends, I think that there's sensible politics. You know, Joel hit the nail on the head. You look at these states and you look at these states, and if you're an urban coaster, you probably dismiss them as red states and therefore redneck states. But what there is going on is a kind of voluntary socialism that I think is far superior to the mandated socialism given to us by government. So there's a light hand of government, but people do come together as a community, and you get the best of both worlds. Also, these states do not tend to do as well in stock market bubbles, and they do better when the rest of the company is unwinding from a bubble. And it's not just North Dakota and Iowa. I mean, you look at some of the best state leadership in the United States right now is coming out of Indiana. Governor Mitch Daniels is running a surplus or a near surplus in a state that is 10 times the population size of North Dakota. So the North Dakota model can scale up, at least to the size of Indiana.
Wow. Let's get a call from Omaha, Nebraska. Tom, you're on the air, Tom.
Hey, thank you. Mm-hmm. I would like to kind of dovetail into what he was saying, that when people come back to there is a lot of people who do leave the area, but every time when I came back to Omaha after living in Chicago for many years, I was amazed by how much things had changed. The cultural diversity, and when I kind of left, it was, and I went to Chicago for college. But when I came back, I was amazed, and when my friends do come back into town, they're always amazed by how much the city has changed. We've got a huge, vibrant arts and entertainment area here that didn't exist a while ago. A lot of these towns that are in the Midwest and that people do think of as just flyover country are, in fact, thriving and being great.
So, and we're hearing it today, Tom. I appreciate your call. Let's get one more from the region. Winner, South Dakota, Michael. Michael, you're on the air.
I just would like to make the point that while the Dakotas, both North and South, have tons of opportunities, if you'd be considering moving to South Dakota, you'd probably really want to move east of the river.
What's the difference east and west? Fill us in, Michael.
Well, actually, the Dakota should have been divided into east and west instead of north and south, because they're similar that way, more similar than they are the other. And western South Dakota is still kind of wild, you know. We've got all the reservations, and you know, there's some, not really uprisings, but there's some wild times, of especially around the first of the month when liquor seems to flow a lot. And so I just wanted to make the point of anybody considering moving to South Dakota really should look in and would want to move east of the river.
Okay, there's some very practical advice. Deborah, what do you make of that?
I don't know what to make of that. I spend the summers, I have a home in South Dakota, in western South Dakota, around the Black Hills, actually about 3 or 4 miles outside of Sturgis, the world's largest biker rally every August. And things get a little wild for that week when about 500,000 people come into my town of 7,000 for a biker rally. But other than that, it's a ranching more so in the western part of actually both states, South Dakota, mm-hmm. North Dakota, South Dakota mm-hmm. more so, but I don't see that there's a significant cultural difference between east and west.
What do you see longer term, Deborah? Do you think this is going to last, and do you see like populations growing? If it's 600,000 now, will it be 1.2 million 10 years from now or 20? Is that possible?
It's possible. The guess in the early 1900s was that North Dakota would be 2 million people. That was the guess as people were coming in. And even the late 1800s, the Homestead Act of 1862, they were saying there were going to be, you know, 1 million farmers and there would be 1 million town people to support those 1 million farmers. So the projection 100 years ago was for 2 million people. Actually, the highest population North Dakota's ever had was in 1930, a little over 680,000, and we're the only state in the nation that's less population than 1930, and the United States has tripled in population since then. But as we look at the long term and we look at the growing needs worldwide for food and energy, the two mainstays of life, that's right on target with where North Dakota is. Food and energy. It's what we do here.
Well, it is fascinating to see how regions' fortunes shift and change over time. And this is really an interesting shift right now. Deborah Dragseth, we appreciate your being with us from Dickinson State University there in North Dakota. Thanks so much for being with us today, Deborah.
Thank you, Tom. It's been an honor.
Rich Carlgaard, it's great to hear from you again. And thank you for your thoughts today. Thanks for joining us from Forbes.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. And Joel, maybe I'll see you in the Bismarck Airport again.
maybe.
You may cross paths. Joel Kotkin, author of the Newsweek piece, The Great, Great Plains and the Next 100 Million. Joel, thanks so much for your time today.
It was my pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.